What characteristics of the rising generation gives you the most hope for the future?
Humility. Humility where we see humility. I think this is our greatest hope. What's the greatest hope in the young generation?
I don't know if I could answer that one right now. What's the greatest hope? I put a lot of hope in them because my estimation, this country depends on this next generation. And we as parents better make sure they're ready for it. This country falls or stands what this next generation does. I don't know how many of you have read the communist goals for this country in the 1950s, but our public education system adopted them about 6 years ago in Denver, Colorado. We've got to get back to teaching in the home. Comes back down to that. I see a lot of hope. We see some young people. We don't have enough young people out there yet that are really strong, and I see as the teacher, especially in the area I'm in, we don't have enough young ones. We desperately need women teachers who can teach women, because what I see in TV is horrible. We're not getting our women trained to teach the women groups, especially on this issue. We're devoid there. Anson's Genesis has Dr. Georgia Purnham. She's a scientist, but she might speak a little high for some people. But we need good women training. Our ministry's been looking not to hire them, but to get them trained. And we have succeeded in some. We have some dynamic women out there doing some of the teaching. But guys, we need you to stand up. You will probably never really know the America that I have known unless we do something about it. So the hope comes from my generation repenting and getting the job done, which we haven't done, and pouring ourselves into this next generation so they can see America.
The other thing I was going to say is that we did a Gen 2 survey. I'm going to share a little bit of that in about a half an hour, of 10,000 millennials and those that are sticking with the faith and those that are leaving the faith. We're living in an era where, 60, 70, 80% of millennials are walking away from the church, and yet 30 to 40% of them are staying. And so we did a survey and found the factors that we felt were the most critical in encouraging the continuity of faith. And it's really an interesting survey. It's probably the most interesting survey. I don't want to be too biased, but the most interesting survey of millennials that's out there, because it's a spiritual survey. But one of the things that I will not share the next hour, because I won't have time, is that we follow their church journeys, and every church was losing the millennials except for a couple of denominations. Meaning that the Baptists were losing, the mainline Presbyterians were losing, the you name it, Lutherans, Catholics, the Church of Christ. So every one of them were losing millennials, except for one or two evangelicals, and I think the Mormon Church. And we asked another question. And that question was, is your church likely to mentor you, disciple you, and hold you accountable? And the churches that were discipling and mentoring and holding accountable were the only churches that were really growing with a millennial population. The millennial population was flocking to them. Again, only two or three of the denominations were growing, and they were really growing. Along with, of course, the agnostics, atheists, and such were gaining. That denomination was gaining as well. But every other church denomination was losing. In other words, the millennials are not going to go to the big box churches where there's a big show. That's what we've concluded. The millennial generation is not into it for the show. They're just not into it for the show. You can keep your Gen Xers excited for the next 6 years or whatever, with a show, with a dry eyes presentation of the big band or whatever. But that's not going to attract the millennials. It's not going to be the music program. It's going to be the discipleship. So the last 12 years of my ministry, we've invited young men to live in our homes. In my home, I've probably mentored 25 young men over that period of time. And now our home is packed with young people coming in on a Sunday night, coming on Saturday mornings, Friday nights. They stay overnight with us. Typically, we have young people staying overnight 7 days a week. Mentorship is all over the place. Discipleship's all over the place. Our prayer meetings are packed with young people. They're monopolizing most of the prayer meetings. In other words, 80 to 90% of the prayer meetings, it's young people, 17 to 24, 25 years of age, that are attending and praying in our prayer meetings. I believe that millennials will be interested, not all of them, but many of them will be interested in dropping their cell phone and regaining relationship, discipleship. I mean, intensive, accountable discipleship. If you're willing to sign up for that, I think there'll be a ministry there with young people. So, there's hope.
Good. Okay. As our children come into their older teen years, at what point is it advisable for us to place them and / encourage them to pursue primary education, then in parentheses, discipleship, outside the home, family, parent? In other words, when is it advisable to set them under another mentor, it sounds like? Perhaps even going away geographically for this.
Every family is different. Every child is different. You know, it's hard to draw a fast rule. As I mentioned, if they're sons of single moms, it might be good just to step up a little more male mentorship in the church. You know, maybe if a dad is taking his two sons along with him on a fishing trip or a hunting trip, bring along the 13-year-old boy with him. You know, just think about including him in one-off opportunities. So at 13 or 14 years of age. So, you know, if there's single moms, let's make sure we're right there helping out with the young men. And in my case, I'll just speak to my case. I think my son did really well gaining more mentorship at 17 or 18 years of age. That was a really good move. Now, sending him away from home, again, every family is different. I think he was probably maybe more like 19 when he went off to the East Coast and hung out with the guy who was an entrepreneur for a number of weeks. It might have been a month or two. So, you know, he's had lots of those opportunities, and that helped him to be the man he is today. My son, by the way, did not go to college. He's got a really good computer job right now, but he went to YouTube U. We like to say YouTube U. He got all his lessons on programming from YouTubes and online tutorials, and saved himself $120,000 and a bad worldview, and wound up with a very good job. So I'm thankful. That obviously isn't something everybody can do, but if there are other alternatives. I really encourage homeschoolers to think outside of the box. I know it can be sometimes a challenge when someone steps up and says, you know, you're already out of the box, so when it comes to college, don't waste your money. Try to find a better way to do this. The brick-and-mortar college is just about done. Do you know there's a million less college students today than there was 6 years ago? It's fallen off a million students. That would be like 60 or 70 large universities closing down, like 16,000 student universities, 60 to 70 of them closing down in just the last 6 years. Is that extraordinary? We have reached the college bust. The balloon has busted and will continue to bust. So let's find better ways to do this. Did I answer the question?
I would agree with every child's different. You're the mother and father. As long as that child is in your house, you're setting the rules, correct? Yeah, you're setting the rules, the standards. But at some point in time, you need to be training them to be young men and young women to be able to make more decisions on their own based on what they can handle at the time. And sometimes they're going to make a wrong decision, and how you handle that's going to be very important. But they're going to have to be independent. They're going to leave sometime, and your job is to train them to be able to be a young man, young woman that can be independent. When that happens, a lot of it happens when you do go off to college. They learn to make their own decisions, make their own friends, and they're under their own control at that point. So, again, I agree. College is not for everybody. Sometimes it can be just as dangerous to go to a Christian college as it is a secular college, because you can come out not believing. And I've seen that over and over again, people coming out of Christian schools not believing. How much money are you willing to spend? But then again, sometimes college is necessary for certain jobs, especially in a management field. We've gone through that turmoil where you didn't have to go to college to be a computer person. I went through that with Microsoft. So all these people didn't have any degrees. They were just as smart as anybody else. They learned the computers on their own. We've kind of passed that stage now. Now they're looking more college degrees, but not entirely. You can still get a pretty good job in computers based on what you know, not how many degrees you have. But then again, to get an upper-level management job, it's difficult without that degree. So you have to weigh what kind of job they want to have.
Okay. Yeah, there are a lot more opportunities out there. I'm curious on that loss of enrollment on the college level. Is that on across the board? Is it on campus college enrollment? Do you know? Because there are so many online opportunities, just even YouTube. I wonder what the enrollment is there. But in my own family, I'll just mention here because they got one question left so far, so if you have another question, you can submit it. I don't think anybody put another one up there. But in my own family, we had a, we've had a couple or two or three situations of placing the child outside the home for mentoring, and it included even physically, geographically changing. My oldest son, is Josiah here? Yeah, my oldest son, I think he was 18 to 19, right in there, and he essentially went under an apprenticeship of how to learn to ranch. Basically, he became an individual in an apprentice situation in a intensive grass-fed organic ranching, and now he's a rancher, and he learned to do that. In fact, the meat that you ate, he raised. You can feel good. It was healthy raised meat, okay? And my daughter, my oldest daughter, and this is interesting because there came to a point which I realized, okay, marriage isn't in her future at the moment. She never went to college. In fact, we were attending a certain church at the time that she graduated. We had a graduation from high school, and, you know, it was the idea there that you go to college, and she wasn't going to college, and the families in the church, they were like, what is she going to do? Okay, well, when marriage wasn't immediately in the future, and my oldest daughter was quite gifted in organizing and in help coordinating and so forth, I allowed her to go clear across the country to work with a worldview ministry, clear across the country. At the same time, a group was possibly going to have her and I speak at a father-daughter thing. But when they found out that my daughter went out from under my home, they couldn't believe it. They told me, you never put your daughter under another man. And I thought, wait a minute. She has a gifting, and I don't believe she's fully able to exercise it where she's at and a door is open. She went and not only has helped that ministry and learned certain skills, another organization called Samaritan Ministries observed her, and they saw how skillful she was. And they were needing a personal assistant to one of their directors. And they actually talked to that worldview ministry and asked if they thought they could talk to her. And she ended up having a position, never going to college, and had the position of being a personal assistant to a director of Samaritan Ministries, and actually became the program developer. My daughter became the program developer for the Morning Center, that Samaritan Ministry started. Yeah, God can open doors. You don't have to go away to college. Now, I'm not opposed to college. I've got an online college I'm going to be establishing here pretty soon with a biblical Christian worldview in every subject, okay? Okay, so there's a few examples. What is the most influential book for evangelicals in the 2000s?
The Bible.
The Bible. Maybe the question had to do with what's the more important book to be reading besides the Bible. Granted, we read other books. I noticed there's a few back there on that table. And oh yes, there are a few over here on this table over here as well. Hi, honey. But my recommendation, I was just telling Brenda this the other day. My recommendation is that you read old books. About 80% of your non-Bible reading, I'd recommend to be older books. Books written in the 16th century, in the 17th century, 18th century. That's why we republish as much of the old stuff as possible. I recommend that. I recommend the old commentators over the newer commentators. And there's a lot of these Bible study programs that just are cranking off the presses today, and people are doing these new Bible study programs. I would encourage you to be sure that you double-check Matthew Henry, double-check John Calvin, and other of the great commentators from years past. Why is that? I just don't trust this age. This is not an impressive age when it comes to the Christian faith. We are in serious retrograde. I'm not saying don't read my stuff. There's always the 20%, but just honestly, read the other things. Don't read the stuff, the schlocky stuff coming out of your typical American Christian evangelical bookstore today. And by the way, they're all bankrupt anyway, so.
Yeah, the Puritans are good ones to read and study those. There are some good ones out there today, but you have to be discriminatory to know, are they compromising somewhere? Like, you had the book yesterday, the great big thick book called Theistic Evolution. Oh, yeah. That was supposedly going against theistic evolution, but I noticed the authors of it, they're all theistic evolutionists and don't claim they are. But you have to look carefully in the book. They have some good information in there. What is the example of? You got a gallon of water, put one drop of cyanide in there. That's what they've done. Because there are about five different places in the book. They say, oh, the age of the earth doesn't matter. It doesn't affect any other part of Scripture. That's because they all believe in an old earth. And in there, they do allude to an old earth being more scientific than a young earth. So that kind of a book I would not recommend. Be very careful. And you have to know something when you read some of these books. There are some good authors out there. They've got to be very careful. We have some apologists, like some of you know their names, but there a lot of people follow them. But they're on certain issues, they're absolutely wrong. They'll poison you with some of this stuff. So, again, it's really tough to give a good one. It depends on what field you're in, what's going to affect you. Some people get affected by a good gospel book that's very plain and gives a good gospel presentation in it. But, again, you got Christian bookstores, they're owned by secular people. And they're there to do what? Make money is their number one reason. And you go in there, you're going to find all kinds of books that are not biblical. So you need to find out who's a good author. Can he be trusted? Check those things out. Then you get the books. There are certain organizations that I work with, like Answers in Genesis, Institute for Creation Research, that they sell it. Most likely it's going to be very good because they check what they sell. You got about 98% chance of getting a book that's good, sound, biblically and scientifically. So if you know organizations that are got a good reputation and you can trust, go to those. But again, depends on your field. But number one, take everything back to the Bible. That's your authority and your test for everything.
We did a program that will air on Monday, maybe one of our more controversial programs, on children's books, on Christian children's books. There's an author, the most popular evangelical Christian children's book author in America, and the second most popular or most published Christian author today, Sally Lloyd-Jones is her name. And she's got a book called The Child's Bible Storybook. And but she's also got a new book out in which she has incorporated a picture of a homosexual family. It's called The Goldfish Trip or something. And so I treat this in my program. So be very cautious. I point out, actually, I don't really spend much time with that, but I point out her introduction to the children's storybook, which has sold 2 million copies. So I'm sure they're in your church. I'm sure families in your church have them. She's a PCA gal. She's seen as conservative. Sally Lloyd-Jones, no connection to Martin Lloyd-Jones, just another Lloyd-Jones. But I caution you about Sally Lloyd-Jones' stuff in the introduction to her book, her Bible story book for kids. She says, the Bible is not a book of rules. It's a love story. So she does the typical evangelifish approach where she sets the law of God against the grace of God. And it's horrific. It's reductionistic. It's the either-or fallacy. It's just horrific when people do that. So her worldview concerning the law of God is obviously corrupted, and so it's no surprise to me that she would incorporate a homosexual family. In fact, on the Twitter account, she responds to a homosexual and says, yes, I'm so excited about being inclusive. And her illustrator said he plans on doing more books for homosexuals as well. So here again, we see how this horrible breakdown of evangelical Christianity is affecting little children as well. And it's very sad. So Bible first, 80% of your other reading, old stuff, and then Mike's stuff and my stuff for the other 20%.
Okay, yeah, I would encourage you to pick up anything off their tables. Well, I will mention this, that I think, you know, we ought to know what we believe. And I think a very good book that is on my table is R.C. Sproul's Everyone's a Theologian. I think it is the best layman's presentation of systematic theology, just an introduction to it, there is. And it's not like the big 2,000-page systematic theologies. It's a nice, readable size, very well done, very good explanation of basic doctrine. So that'd be a recommendation.